RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
There was a moment in the late 70s, following the impact of punk, when Manchester became the focus of a new wave of all things musical, with bands like Joy Division, New Order, The Happy Mondays, and Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. The graphic presentation of these bands spawned a new generation of designers, especially those involved with Tony Wilson's Factory Records and the infamous Hacienda Nightclub. My guest today was there at the start. His early teenage obsession with Tropical Fish gave way to music, and a part-time job in a discount record store gave him a unique insight into Manchester's musical explosion. For over 25 years, Mark Farrow has been at the forefront of designing music packaging. His work is both collected and coveted, and very rarely ends up in the recycled bin. He has won every design accolade in the book, including Britain's highest honour, Royal Designer for Industry. He strives for simple perfection, and his approach has attracted many clients from the wider creative fields of product design, photography, interior and furniture design. I spoke to him at his studio in London's Bloomsbury. You were born in 1960.
Yep.
And as so much of your life has been about music, I thought you'd be interested to know who was top of the charts in 1960. Mm-hmm. It was Chubby Checker with The Twist.
Well, never tried The Twist. I think I kind of... it was long gone by the time I was dancing.
Before I kind of, you know, go back to your background, just observation, really. The thing I've noticed about designers work within the music industry, and I'm talking about graphic designers, of course, their work gets mythologized, you know, very quickly. And I'm thinking of people like Barney Bubbles and Storm Thorgerson and obviously Peter Saville and Vaughan Oliver, people like that whose work is highly regarded. I just wonder what is it particularly about the album sleeve and the CD cover that causes such an interest in and following, as opposed to, you know, other areas apart from, say, stamps, where you've got a whole world of philatelists. What is it, do you think, that
I just think it goes hand in hand with bands. It's rock and roll, essentially, I think, is what it's about. Certainly when I was 16, 17, all I wanted to do was design album covers, and it was because I just felt drawn to it. It just felt very, very natural. In fact, I didn't think about it at all. It was just what I wanted to do. And I think I never really particularly wanted to be in a band. I love bands. Music was everything to me at that point. Still is to a large degree. But I wanted to do the covers. I didn't want to be in the band.
So when did that kind of manifest itself? I mean, you were born in 1960, so really I suppose your period would have been, or when you were becoming aware of things, would have been well into the sort of 70s, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly the first kind of bands that, I mean, I was like everyone else. It was kind of 14 and 15 at that point. The only choice, if you didn't like kind of out-and-out pop music that was on the radio, then you liked kind of Pink Floyd and Yes and Genesis and those kind of bands. And so did I, to a certain degree, running with my peers. But then 76, 77, all that changed when
yeah, I think
punk
if I
happened.
Remember, all of those bands, the ones you've just mentioned, they all got incredibly pretentious and overproduced.
Absolutely. Overblown in every possible way, I suppose, you know, arguably from their artwork to their stage shows to their kind of 25-minute songs and so on.
And solos.
Just blown out of all proportion, really.
Let's just roll back a little bit. Just tell me a little bit about your childhood and your general background. You were born in Manchester.
I was born in Manchester to kind of working-class parents who aspired to do better than their parents had done and all the rest of it, and aspired to myself and my sister doing better than they had in turn. Mm. And a very kind of nurturing background, as in, I'm sure I was a constant worry to them because I was never quite as good at school as I should have been. One thing that I suppose I would say, or anything that I did want to do and really believed in, I was always very good at. So maths at school, not great. Keeping Tropical Fish when I was 12 or 14, I could give you the Latin name of any fish that you pointed out in a book. So it kind of worked like that with me. I was kind of always going to be what I was going to be. And I think my parents had a sense of that.
Well, that you had a kind of inner passion for things.
That when I believed in something and I was good at something, and I suppose the hope was that eventually I would find something that I wanted to excel at and I would excel. Mm. But certainly it wasn't necessarily academia.
So what were you excelling at when you were at school?
I was kind of quite good at drawing. I wasn't exceptional.
Yeah.
I used to resent the fact that my history lessons at school were learning about the Industrial Revolution as opposed to the Romans and the Egyptians, for want of a better term. I was a bit of a nature boy. I always had a fascination with animals and I always kept pets. And I would have loved, you know, I dreamed of being a marine biologist and all these kind of things. And for many years, when I was a kid, I kept tropical fish and bred tropical fish. I had like a ridiculous number of fish tanks in my bedroom when I was a kid.
So was Jacques Cousteau before your time? Or
absolutely.
Was that something
Jacques Cousteau was my hero, totally. My dad and I used to sit down and watch him. Yeah, absolutely. Not necessarily John Denver, but certainly the documentaries. So that was always big with me. And then, you know, I still love those things. I still have a fascination with it and just seem to be able to kind of talk about it. You get to have those conversations with people who go, how the hell do you know this stuff? And I just know it. I don't know how I know it, if you know what I mean. Certainly when in a natural history kind of way. I kind of snapped out of that at kind of 16, 17 when Girls and Music happened, if you like.
So what happened at school towards the end of your career? So, I mean, did you go on to further education?
I mean, a very short period, I was accepted at Tameside College as a full-time course to eventually, with the view to becoming a graphic designer.
Yeah.
And I was there for a very short period of time. I struggled with it from the off. I struggled with the idea that a tutor would maybe say, okay, you're going to create an identity, if that was the term. You're going to create a logo for a shop today. And even at that stage, I would find myself going, what kind of shop is it? And they'd say, well, it's whatever kind of shop you want it to be. And I was instantly turned off by that idea because I wanted
people
to set me tasks. Yeah. I didn't want to set my own task. You're an artist if you do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so on that level, I struggled a bit. I mean, it's always been that I like to be given a brief so I can ignore it. But I have to be given the brief in the first place.
In order to ignore it, yeah.
In order to ignore it, yeah.
So you lasted just a few months or so?
If that. I started in the September and I was there a few weeks. And I applied for a job as a junior finished artist in a Central Manchester art studio.
Right.
And I said to the tutor, I can't actually remember whether I was offered the job. I went for the interview and was offered the job, or whether I said I'm thinking of applying for this job. But either way, I asked him what he thought, and he kind of said, well, there's nothing better than learning on the job, in a very kind of, you know, kind of northern way. And so I either applied for it or I accepted it. I can't remember which way around it was. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I was kind of up and running then.
So this would be a traditional commercial art studio?
Yes, absolutely. Working at a drawing board, cow gum everywhere and scalpel cuts and all the rest of it. So that's what I was doing. And then this was running concurrently with my music fascination and my life outside of work. You know, I kind of moved about then. I worked in various, as you do in that kind of role. I worked between literally finished art studios, couple of small design companies and advertising agencies, you know, in that kind of very below the line agencies.
So you went from job to job?
Over a period of time. And all the time, I used to, for example, I worked in this little record store on a Saturday.
Yeah.
One of my best mates worked in Virgin full time.
Yeah.
He became one of my best mates because I used to hang around in Virgin every lunchtime.
Yeah.
I'd come out of work in my lunch hour and go and hang about, listen to new music and look at what's going on. And then eventually I got my own job on a Saturday working in a little place. It was a place called the Underground Market in the centre of Manchester. It was all kind of stalls selling clothes, hundreds and hundreds of them. And one of them was a little record store, probably 15 foot square, very small, a unit in effect that had a shutter down the front. And punk had happened and I worked in this store. And everyone was designing their own sleeves. And every inch of wall space in this place had 7-inch record sleeves blue tacked to it.
So this would have been the Sex Pistols that appeared at the Free Trade Hall.
This would be 77, 78. Yeah, yes, okay. Yes. I'm not one of the one of the few people in Manchester who don't claim to have been
there
at the Lesser Free Trade Hall when Sex Pistols.
So played. At this time you had Buzzcocks, Joy Division,
You didn't quite have Joy Division then. No. You didn't have Smiths. This was pre that. This was punk. This was Buzzcocks. And it was all the Buzzcocks and Magazine and the very early mumblings of Factory Records forming the possibility. Yeah. And what was fascinating for me was that all these people came in to this little record. This was the place by your independent records, if
right,
you know what
okay,
I mean.
Yeah, I do.
People were literally releasing records from their bedroom at this point. Something that hadn't...
So it was like the Rough Trade sort of...
Rough Trade stuff was coming out on Rough Trade, but it was also literally coming out, you know, on a release-by-release basis. Yeah. People were forming a band, making a record, releasing it, doing their own sleeve, or getting their mates to do a sleeve.
Yeah.
So I suppose, in that respect, I was born at the right time, because had we all
And
just,
in the right place.
And in the right place. Yeah. Had we just carried on listening to Yes and Genesis, I'd have probably never got to do their sleeves. No. But thankfully, the whole punk thing exploded, and punk itself lasted no time at all. I was never a punk. I was probably, as a 16, 17-year-old, just kind of excited.
I always find this interesting because, you know, punk, it's like all these things. Any kind of style gets to a point where it starts to celebrate itself and become boring. And someone will come along and say, let's get rid of that and we'll do something... We'll do the unplugged. We'll be simple, and it's the same. It was the same at the time with design. There was a lot of stick and paste, and you know that whole antidote to crafted design that came along. And it's always very interesting when that happens. But all that does, it seems to be a sort of a mini revolution, and then something happens straight after, which suddenly becomes more sophisticated.
Absolutely, absolutely. Inevitably, there's this kind of explosion, and actually. In the great scheme of things, that the explosion is just a catalyst for something to then begin, properly, and that's very much what happened. People realised that they could release their own records. People who realised they could start their own record label and release records by other people. And of course, that there was suddenly the opportunity for me to be able to work. At that time, it was kind of fascinating because the people who were starting these record labels, like Tony Wilson and Rob Gretton, who was the other partner in Factory, and Peter Saville and Malcolm Garrett, used to come into this record store and buy their records. So I think Peter...
And did you know who they were?
Yes, I think Peter and Malcolm were both just out of college. Malcolm first was doing Buzzcocks, and Peter came a little later, because, you know, I'm talking months. Because Factory hadn't started, and Peter had done his first, probably for the Factory as a venue, he'd done the first poster and stuff like that. So I was kind of surrounded by these people at that point. Factory started up, and Factory was releasing stuff, and there was nothing I wanted more in the world than to design a Factory record sleeve at that point. That was the aim. That's what I wanted to do. And of course, as a consequence of working in this record shop and all these people coming in, I was meeting these bands, I was talking to them, and during the time that I was there, these kids who used to come in formed a band called the Stockholm Monsters, and I was their mate in as much as I saw them every Saturday in this record shop. And they said, we want you to do our record sleeves. Up until that point, all I'd done is maybe handbills for various places, you know, around Manchester. I hadn't done anything for The Factory or Factory Records at that point.
Yeah.
But there was another place called Rafters where Rob Gretton, who was the manager of New Order and a partner in Factory, he was the DJ there.
Mm.
So I knew, at least I knew who these people were, but I gradually got to know them through them coming in the record shop.
So, in a way, it's quite interesting that the very era that you were absorbed in this music shop was really your mini university, because you probably...
Totally.
I would think, rather like you've mentioned all the Goldfish, you probably knew all the record labels, who recorded on what, the serial numbers, you know, the way that some record collectors become absolutely obsessed.
Absolutely, and I used to have this little bit in the cupboard where I was allowed to stash the stuff that I wanted. And you'd, things would come in and you'd know that there'd only be 1,000 of them pressed, and they'd gone all over the country, and you knew that there was probably going to be 5 of them in Manchester or 10 of them in Manchester.
Have you kept all of those?
And well, I've got the ones I've got, but inevitably my cupboard was always bulging and I could never actually afford. Of course, I never actually earned any money during the time because it all just went on records. But it was, you know, it was a weird kind of thing, because the work I was working on at work as a designer or as a finished artist or whatever it was at any given point was dull as ditch water, and I had no freedom of expression within the confines of the studios where I worked.
So were you using that purely as a means for ends to learn, if you like, learn the craft as it was then?
Well, I wasn't intentionally, but no. Yes, ultimately.
Yeah. So tell me, so you started to do more and more covers, and so how did things progress?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, I kind of desperately wanted to do my Factory Sleeve and stuff, but I suppose in between, the big moment was knowing Rob Gretton, and Factory had started up, and they'd released their Factory Sampler, which was the first thing that Peter did, that was kind of fascinating, and it was something that you'd never seen before, and it was influenced by the whole kind of pioneers of new typography stuff, which of course I knew nothing about. I didn't know any of this. Yeah. Peter and Malcolm were completely ensconced in it. I didn't know any of this. In fact, at one point, Peter Saville said to me, "You should buy this book," and told me what it was. And sure enough, I bought it. And you were like, kind of, "Oh, there's Malcolm's Buzzcock sleeve." You know, it was that kind of thing. Yeah. But at that point, I thought they were making it up. I was making it up. I thought they were making it up. But the big shift, and I've kind of talked about this before, was when Rob Gretton said to me, "I'll give you a copy of the Joy Division album," and came in with a 12-inch cardboard mailer, as promised, "Here's your Joy Division album," and kind of taking out Unknown Pleasures out of its sleeve. And just paradigm shift moment, when everything that I thought I could do, or what a record sleeve could be, just shifted beyond all comprehension. New world opened up at that exact moment. The idea,
so that was your epiphany.
The idea, total epiphany. The idea that you could basically do nothing and it could look fantastic. Yeah. That sounds unfair, but you know what I mean.
Of course I do, yeah. Okay, so obviously the big shift for you then. So what happened after that?
Was shortly after that, what I mentioned slightly earlier about the guys who came in forming a band. Yeah. They formed their band that happened to be called the Stockholm Monsters, and their first track was called Fairy Tales. And they wanted me to do the sleeve, and I had to go down to present my visuals to Tony Wilson, who of course was a famous local TV reporter, you know, as well as being the founder of Factory Records.
Yeah.
And I had to go to Granada Studios, where I think New Order were recording something for So It Goes, which was Tony's programme.
Yeah.
And I had to show up with my visuals rolled up under my arm, and show them to Tony, who just said, "Yeah, great, get on with it." And it was that simple. I had my first Factory Sleeve, which I laboured over. It was interesting. What was interesting actually was I couldn't decide whether I wanted to do the red design I'd done, the kind of claret coloured design I'd done, or the green one. And Tony Wilson said, "Well, why don't you just do them both?" And that was another epiphany. That was I've kind of expected.
That's actually very interesting.
I've expected that level of client.
Because actually, thinking about your work, you know, subsequently, you know, you seem to have had that amazing flexibility to be able to do, well, I do two or three even.
Yes.
Of the thing, which we'll talk about a little later. So, okay, you're now fully fledged sleeve designer working in an area to some degree.
I'm working in crappy little studios during the week.
I'm doing my
sleeves. Yeah.
How did it develop from there?
If we jump on by this time, I've got none of the work that I'm doing within the studios where I'm working is of any relevance to me whatsoever. At the last place I worked before I moved to London, I was kind of in the finished art studio.
Yeah.
And I'd made many numerous attempts to move into the kind of creative part of the studio to no ends whatsoever. I mean, it just wasn't going to happen. I was, as far as they were concerned, I was a finished artist, and that's all I would be.
Mm.
there seemed no choice but to start to look further afield, really, to think about moving to London. If I wanted to design for music, which I suppose specifically that's all I not all I wanted to do, but that's specifically what I wanted to do at that point. If I was going to do that, then I was going to have to do it in London, realistically, because there was only so many records that Factory released, and they certainly weren't going to pay for me to live. So I started thinking about London. I applied from Creative Review in 1985, I think it was. I applied for a job at a company called XL Design. And XL Design at that point in time were a really big noise, mainly because they were doing all the work for ZTT, which was Trevor Horn and Paul Morley, who at that time, it was Frankie Goes to Hollywood, were everywhere. So the Frankie Says t-shirts, all that stuff was being done by XL Design. From a kind of aesthetic point of view, I didn't especially like the work they were doing. But I saw it as a big opportunity. So I applied for the job, and I basically came down to London on the train, and I had five pieces of Factory work, six or seven handbills, and other bits and pieces that I designed for that I thought were good. But none of the work I'd done in my full-time career as a designer stroke finished artist, interestingly. And I applied for the job. I came down, I was interviewed, and by the time I'd got back to Manchester that night and got home, my mum said, XL Design have been on the phone for you and they want to offer you the job. They obviously made a pretty quick decision on that. I don't know who else had applied.
So you would have been what, 20?
No, 20? I was older than that. I was 24, 25.
Oh, right, okay.
25.
Yeah. Okay. So you had a long slog up there and working
Studio. Yeah, considering I essentially started working when I was like 16, 17. Absolutely. So I came down to London, which, as you can imagine, was a nightmare at first. You move to London, you don't know a soul. And it was all a bit grim, to be honest, for a while. Didn't especially like the work I was doing. And then part of XL had a couple of extra divisions. They had big features, which made pop promos, which of course was a new art then almost. That was at the beginning, or certainly at the point when it was getting really big. And they had like Andy Morahan and Matt Forrest, who were kind of big names in that world. Matt Forrest, animator. Andy Morahan was a filmmaker. And though all that, they were on one floor, and XL was on the floor below, and the floor above that was Massive Management. So there was a management section, and there was a design section, and there was, you know, so in theory, you had a one-stop shop if you were an artist. You could move in, you could have your sleeves done, you could be managed by them, and you could
Have your videos
made. At least that was the idea. Of course, the way it was set up meant that the whole thing kind of went horribly wrong by the Christmas of the year I started. But in between, one of the bands that were managed by Massive Management were Pet Shop Boys. So that's the next big moment, if you like.
Well, next big moment, and the moment that stayed with you ever since.
Yeah.
And we can talk a little bit about the more recent album, yes, but tell me a little bit about that meeting and how you developed into this long-term relationship.
Well, of course, what happened was that they were managed, and XL had already, I think, designed a couple of things for them. They designed the original release of their first single, Opportunities. Then they'd released West End Girls. Mm-hmm. And West End Girls was just about on its way to being a hit record. Mm-hmm. And they were working on their first album, Please. And what happened was suddenly they're told that there's this new designer for Manchester who worked at Factory Records. And of course, that holds massive appeal for Neil and Chris, because the whole Factory thing, they really like. So that whole kind of what they would term, what I suppose you would term minimal streak, was appealed to them greatly, and the connection with Factory and all the rest of it. It felt like a good one. And so I was set to work. The first thing I ever did was a 10-inch remix of West End Girls. And at this point, they were using this logo that had all different typefaces in it and stuff like that. I stripped all the type off it and just left the patterns, so it looked exactly the same as the original release, except there was only the background and all the type had gone, and it just had a sticker on it with the information. So it was an exercise in reduction. And it went from there. It was like, okay, let's start work on the album, on the first album. In between, XL went bust because of the nature of the way it was. I think, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, I think it was the video part that dragged it down. Mm-hmm. They were all set up. It was a kind of all set up as one company. And so the whole thing came to a crashing halt at Christmas. And I returned with my tail between my legs to Manchester for a couple of weeks.
Oh, right, okay.
And then I got a phone call from Tom Watkins, who managed the Pet Shop Boys at the time, said, right, I've set up a new office. Why don't you come and there's a room you can set up as a designer? And he had this idea that I would design every artist that he managed. I would do the sleeves for them. And in the meantime, I'd get other work as well and all the rest of it.
What a nice opportunity.
So that's what I did. I'd already designed Please by that point. And Please is a very simple piece of work. It was designed to be an album cover, CD cover, because we're at that kind of cost. We're still in vinyl. Yeah. And vinyl's the most important thing at this juncture.
Yeah.
And basically, it was a one-inch square photograph taken by Eric Watson that had already been taken. It was nothing to do with me. There was a selection of press shots. And I chose this one, which was Neil and Chris with white towels around their necks. Mm-hmm. And I put it on a white background, and I put 6-point Helvetica type on it. And then I argued with the record company that it would stand out from the visual mess that was the shelves in HMV and Virgin by the very fact that there was nothing there, and it would draw people in, and they would go up to it. I mean, it's funny, because I think about it now, and to some degree, I think I probably designed Unknown Pleasures, but in white, with a picture instead of the image that was on the I've never actually thought about that until this point.
Mm.
But I think tell Peter Sellers.
No, I think is interesting about what you just said. You talked about the kind of cusp of vinyl and the 12-inch album cover and the move across the CD, which was very much frowned upon at the time. I mean, because, you know, I come from a period of the album covers, the fold-out, the whole bit, and the idea of suddenly having to deal with CD covers seemed like, you know, like the end of the world. But the fact of the matter is, what I think about you and what I've always felt about you is that you saw, maybe I'm wrong, but you saw this as a new challenge. And I think your best work is challenging what can be done with the packaging of CDs. I know subsequently you carried on to do special edition vinyl service, yeah. But I think it's in the area of CD covers and what you've done with them that has made so much of your work very special. And I'm thinking, you know, I've got to raise immediately the pharmaceutical packaging, because that was such a breakthrough thing for Spiritualize at the time. And I think that the lead singer referred to their work as medicine for the soul. And I think that's when you got this medical thing going.
In the first meeting I ever had with him, one of the things he said that really, really stuck with me was that he felt that music was medication for the soul.
Medication. Okay.
And that really resonated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's strange because that's one of the only pieces of work that I've ever done that I think could possibly be classed as pastiche. And it's exceptional in that respect as out of my body of work, I suppose.
It's interesting because it seems to me that piece of work, probably of all of your pieces of work, seemed to inform what was to come next.
Very much so.
Simply because of the structural discipline of pharmaceutical packaging and the tradition of pharmaceutical packaging, much of which the greatest was sort of Geigy and Swiss based and all
Absolutely.
That. It seemed to be pointing into a direction.
Yes, and it did. You know, I mean, historically when I've been asked what sort of things I'd like to design, I've always said pharmaceutical packaging, beauty packaging. Those things appeal to me, and they're things that I just feel I would naturally be good at. But yeah, in answer to your original point, yes, I did see CDs as being an opportunity to well, I suppose what essentially happened is you become bored with it, you know. When you're working essentially, as I probably was for most of the time, probably 80% of the time, on a square, you do start to think, what else can I do here? Because you know, you do get bored. Sometimes the content is within that square, but I just started, I suppose the leap was thinking outside of that square and what could I do with the actual format itself. And I think that was born more out of just a frustration of just doing the same thing over and over again. Mm. I mean, you can, when we were working for Deconstruction, which was a dance record label, we were doing 4 and 5 CD covers a month, the height of them firing stuff out. You know, it does get restrictive. So you start to think, what could you do with it? And I suppose that was one of the first opportunities, when we did Spiritualize, that got me outside of that. Using vacuum forming and so on, completely informed what we did next time when we used it. Yeah. I got Don Brown to create bas relief of a face of an Asian woman, who would be his wife, as it happens. But that was because the whole, as much as I'm very proud of the Spiritualized piece of work, ultimately I it nags that it's a pastiche. And so I felt I wanted to do something that wasn't, and that was that the next album was me escaping that, I suppose.
Although you have recently revived that cover, I mean, it's a special.
That's about to be re-released. Yeah.
It's a black cover,
we've done it all in black, and we've done black CDs, black on both sides. And a black pill pack and black instruction leaflet.
Which is the complete opposite to...
Yes. And funnily enough, I feel a lot more comfortable with this one, because this clearly isn't past it. It's moved into a whole new realm. But, it's funny, we had a lot of fun with that packaging at the same time. I mean, the lengths we went to were just ridiculous, really. I mean, it was packed in a medical facility, because the leaflet that came with it had to be packed by people who print medical leaflets, because they're the only people who've got a machine that folds a piece of paper as many times as an instruction leaflet with pills is folded.
And all the copy that was written.
All the copy, we played with the copy. What are the possible side effects of listening to Spiritualized? What should I do if this doesn't work? You should play the other albums. And we had loads of kind of fun with it. But without it turning into comedy.
Yeah.
Just being kind of...
No, that I think that was the great thing about it. It seemed to be, I mean, you say pastiche, but it was...
It was never meant to be a gag.
No, it was very seriously done. Well, that leads me on to, you know, we touched on Pet Shop Boys, and I wanted to talk about the more recent things that you've been doing with them, and Yes in particular, which came out earlier this year, and then it sort of turned into a much bigger thing because they've had a tour, and you've done lots of special additional pieces.
Mm.
For example, you've done, you know, you did the original cover, which is the tick on the white ground, and then you've then got a black limited edition, and you've got a gold gold tick limited edition. I was just interested, it would be interesting for you to tell the story of how that cover came about, because I know that you'd seen, or they had seen, a Rixer exhibition at the Serpentine, and they were rather enamoured by the simple coloured squares.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see how you collaborate with, you know, with other creatives, not in the graphic field, but in the music field, how these things come together.
I've always had that relationship with Pet Shop Boys has gone on, you know, kind of 25 years in effect now, an incredibly long time. And it's at the point now where they will come in with an idea, and if I have a better one, or my studio has a better one, to be fair, they will go with that idea, and vice versa. Mm. So it's a very good relationship. There's no egos at stake. We're way past that kind of thing. And that was a very typical situation, that Neil and Chris come in. We've done a new album. It's the poppiest album we've done, so we think it should be colourful. Here's the catalogue from the Gerhard Richter show, which obviously we knew anyway. There's your starting point. And at that point, it's called Yes. And that's the starting point. And everyone in the studio starts doing bits and bobs. And then we've got to present some ideas to Neil and Chris, and I'm looking through them, and some are great, some are, you know, not great, and we're doing an edit on our ideas. And then Gary had done one where he'd just done a series of straight lines, a series of squares. Gary's a partner in Farrow, yeah. He's been with him a long time, and he's very important, obviously. He'd done this line of colours, and we talked about maybe each track should be represented by a colour. And at the last minute, I just said, why don't we turn that straight line, which I kind of felt like I'd seen before, into a tick. It's called Yes, and the tick's Yes, and we did it. And I don't even remember, because normally I'm very kind of, yes, that's it, we've got it, and I will push and fight for an idea to go through. But I didn't, funnily enough, it was Neil and Chris that jumped, in this instance, it was Neil and Chris that jumped on the tick. We loved the tick, straight away. So we had the tick, and what was interesting there, we'd, as a consequence of making the tick, suddenly we turned all our squares on the diagonal. Mm. So essentially, they weren't ticks anymore, they were diamonds. And that kind of opened it up, that instantly opened it up, because squares we felt we'd done before. Mm. And suddenly we were dealing with diamonds and it felt completely different.
And that led on to a complete typeface.
We started deconstructing the tick, and it's like, shall we create an alphabet? First we did PSB, and then in typical style, Gary will just bury his head in creating the rest of the alphabet. Mm. You know, and that's very much the way we'll work, you know. Mm.
And that produced over the last few months a massive
what was exceptional in this case is that, A, I felt we probably had the strongest campaign image. And it's very interesting that I felt the first time we've actually gone into this, and I felt we were designing this cover not to be a CD. So earlier we talked about album covers. Mm. Let's forget the album cover. Now let's forget the CD cover. Mm. What does it look like on an iPod?
Mm. You were devising a campaign across
We were designing an identity.
Yeah.
For an album release.
Yeah.
And that was the shift this time. Mm. We consciously designed visuals to see what they look like on an iPod.
And also, not just an album release, but for a tour as well.
Well, that was the interesting thing. Once we were up and running, this coincidence, they don't always tour an album. In this instance, they did. Mm. And what happened was, the squares leading into the tick, leading into the diamonds, opened up such a wealth of ideas that we've ended up running with it. They luckily they were doing a world tour, which meant we were doing merchandise, which meant we were doing a tour program, which meant we were doing a badge and all the rest of it. So it really gave us an opportunity to kind of express ourselves. And it's been great. I mean, funnily enough, only today, Neil emailed me about something about the new t-shirt for the next leg of the tour. They're currently home, and the next leg of the tour is to go to Australasia and all the rest of it, and just said, this is the best tour merchandise we've ever had. Mm. And I know it is. Mm. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's just, this has been fantastic as a campaign, and that's why, as you say, as a body of work.
It's a kind of holistic thing.
It's just, it's kind of course, we didn't set out and design something. It's kind of grown. I'm very, very happy with it.
I mean, we've talked a lot about music, in fact, exclusively about music and your your work for that area, but you've done a lot of other things. But you seem to, looking at your body of work, I would say that music, photography, art design, book are the kind of things that you appeared to do mostly, whether that's because you're more comfortable in those areas as opposed to, say, the big corporate jobs. Is that, I mean, I know you have done a few, but generally speaking, you seem to have either not been given the opportunity, or that you've shied against those kind of jobs. Is it because you find the music side, so you get a sense of freedom, more exciting than being given design the identity for an insurance company? How is...
I mean, the truth of that is that I'd say overall we haven't been given the opportunity rather than we haven't wanted to do it. And I suppose there's various reasons, not least the fact that I probably don't quite know how to go after that work. But every project that we've worked on, everything that we've designed as a studio, we've gone into it with the same zest as be it a record sleeve, or whether there's no difference in the approach, really, fundamentally.
No.
We've gone at it in the same way, and being approached to do something different that we've not done before.
Okay, well, let me just say that the difference, as I see it, having been in this business for a long time and having seen the industry evolve, what I see very clearly these days, when being given the opportunity or not the opportunity, or not wanting the opportunity of working in those areas, is that the difference between, for example, working with a group of other creatives, Chris Sloan, Neil Tennant, who are creatives in their right, and they will have a conversation with you and you'll lock into one another. working for large corporate bodies, you have layers of people, and you have, you know, marketing people who often, these days, more often than not, want you to respond in writing. They want you to respond with statistics. They want you to respond in so much paperwork that actually the process of design happens at the very end of a long exchange of ridiculous paperwork, it seems to me. It seems that the design element has got further and further removed. And the strategy, the strategic aspect of design, you know, what it can do, what it means, what it covers, is more important than the end, you know, the thing that perhaps we both feel is more important. And it's removed people from, removed very good people from doing that sort of, I'll give you an example. For example, you know, years ago, you'd have someone like, you know, a very highly talented designer and certainly a great hero of mine, David Gentleman, for example, just having the chief executive, or as they would be called, the managing director of British Steel, phoning him up saying, could you do a letterheading?
Yes.
And he comes up with a terrific logo, which these days it would have gone to one of the big, you know, in quotation marks, branding companies, who would spend 9 months doing, you know, endless interviews and strategy and presentations and endless, you know, here's 500 logos refined and so forth.
And the logo, the end result would be no better than Mr. Gentleman's, would it?
Often far, far worse.
Precisely.
Sadly, because they're given the design aspect is at the end of the process. The money making aspect is at the front end, and it's very sad, you know.
That
really talented designers these days are not. I mean, you know, for example, with a lot of government organisations now, they won't even entertain a designer unless you give them a raft of information about your balance, your insurance situation, you know, endless things that have got nothing to do with at all, but they are boxes that they have to tick.
Yes.
It's a bit like health and safety.
Which is why, in theory, there's myself and lots of other fantastic designers who'll probably never get near the Olympics, for example.
Well, I'm sure you're right. And I mean, we know what the Olympics has looked like so far. And, you know, it's a very sad missed opportunity.
There's an interesting, it's funny what you were just saying then about the British Steel thing. Another version of that is one of the things that we've designed, which I'm very proud of, and I suppose is quite different from a lot of our other work, is Paint and Burn, which is a kind of deli stroke bakery. And that it's the perfect example of where we sit in the world. I work with Oliver Payton, who's a long-standing client, and we argue like cat and dog, but we do great work together, and we have done for probably 15, 20 years now. We created Payton and Burn. We made the name up. We did everything on that. He occasionally employs someone who works as a copywriter, who also happens to work for lots of other big companies as a copywriter, food copywriter. Every time he goes into certain great big supermarket chains, Payton and Burn is on their style boards when they're approaching a project. And that's therein lies the crux of the whole thing. Our work is the inspiration for those people, but those people will never come to me for that work. They'll never go, he's great, let's use him. They go, that's great, do that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's indicative of what's happening.
It's kind of the same thing, though.
It is. I mean, you know, talking about that work, I mean, it is, and it brings me on to the point I wanted to make about your work, is that it is, you know, disarmingly simple in that you talked about that very first Pet Shop Boys. You said yourself that very first Pet Shop Boys album that you did, you said about stripping it down, getting rid of all the stuff that you didn't like and getting back to something that actually was acceptable to you, even though you didn't really like it, but actually stripping it back. And your work appears to me to be about stripping things down to a kind of essence. So you will deal with colour, that's it. You'll have a limited range of typefaces, that's it. The project we've just been talking about, the Painting and Burn, is really gill, caps,
certainly is.
Very simply spaced. on very simple color backgrounds, sort of slightly off colors, yeah. You know, and that's it.
Yeah.
That is it. That is it. But nevertheless, it looks very beautiful and works as an overall image for that organization. And probably had you been going through the gauntlet of, I don't know, one of the big supermarket chains, you would have had to run the gauntlet of several marketing people, buyers, all the rest of it, all putting their oar in saying, isn't it a bit simple? I mean, can't we put a little something in there? Maybe a bit of handwriting might, you know, give it a bit of a, you know, homely quality. So I think my feeling is that what you've just said to me is it really is about relationship. Client designer relationships are really important. And in my experience, the best work that I've ever done has come about because I had a great client who understood basically what it was I was able to do for them.
Yeah.
And they left me alone and appreciated
it. It's an absolute necessity. And also, if you look historically, the vast majority, although we do, obviously, we do projects on a one-off basis and we never hear from people again, the best work that we have produced is with relationships that have lasted a very long time. Mm. Be it Oliver Payton on his restaurants and now Payton and Byrne, be it Pet Shop Boys for 20 years, be it Deconstruction 10 years, basically designing everything for that label. Those relationships have always lasted a very long time and they bear fruit.
A couple of things I want to ask you, which is sort of in a way outside of, you know, what you do on in your sort of the daily event of graphic design, basically.
Yes.
And I'm thinking now a little bit wider about what we actually do, as designers. And the whole, we're kind of beginning to live in an age, or we are living in an age, where questions of conserving resources are becoming a big issue. And graphic designers are beginning to grapple with the whole idea of, you know, over-packaging and all of these things. I mean, I just wonder whether you had a view on that sort of thing. I'm thinking particularly, I suppose, of the world of music packaging, which can be very extravagant. And I just wanted to get your take on that. What do you feel when you're coming up with concepts that maybe are involved with having not just one sleeve for, you know, a set of albums? I think of Pet Shop Boys particularly, where you've got special edition, where you've got lots of sleeves and they all go inside something else and then they come into a complete package. What's your view about that?
Well, my feeling, I know exactly what you're saying, and nobody gets more annoyed than me than when I buy some food and it's massively overpackaged and it's in any number of layers of plastic and all the rest of it, and we're just from the studio point of view, we kind of avidly recycle everything that we possibly can and all the rest of it. So on that level, I'm aware of all that stuff as everybody else is. But in terms of, you know, the example you use, maybe the Pet Shop Boys box set, my view on that is it's not designed to be recycled because it's designed to be this very beautiful thing that in theory will sit there forever to some degree or another. And that's how I get past that, because that's kind of what I believe. Mm. I don't, if it's a single, then I'd rather just put it in a cardboard pochette because it will end up in a bin or in a charity shop or all the rest of it. But when somebody's paying £300 for something like that Pet Shop Boys special edition, it's got to live up to that. And it's meant to. It's meant to be something that you can put on your shelf and will look very beautiful. And in theory, it's not going to go anywhere. It's not disposable.
Okay, well, I understand that completely. Okay.
Is that fair?
No, I think it's absolutely fair. Let me think. Okay, I want to move on to something else now. There's the term designer thinking has been bannered around quite a lot in recent months. Which, in essence, is about transferring the notion of designer thinking to ordinary people, you know, as if it's something that you can implant into the general population. Do you have a view about that, or have you heard about this sort of idea?
If I'm honest, no, I haven't. But a designer has a duty to make the world a better-looking place, and in doing that, you're educating to some degree, if that doesn't sound too patronising. I think by default you're educating people and changing people's perception of what design is by showing them good design. That might be a bit of a utopian vision, but I like to think that's what we're doing. I've always maintained that you're kind of a designer is duty bound to kind of push their client as far as they can towards doing something good and well and fighting every inch of the way. And I ultimately that, you'd like to think, kind of filters through.
Mm. Okay, last question. Are there any areas of design that you would love to be involved with that you're not involved?
Yeah, I'm probably a bit... I'm probably... As a graphic designer, I kind of talked about it briefly earlier, but yeah, the idea of doing pharmaceutical packaging or doing beauty packaging or designing perfume packaging really appeals to me. It's something that I'd really like to do. Never kind of particularly gone after it, but so it is something that I'd like to do.
Have you ever thought about your graphics moving? Turning your graphics?
It's funny because people make that leap. They go, you do record sleeves, therefore you must want to do pop promos. Mm. That was the first way. And I never did. Never at all. I can drive photographers mad with how, to what degree I want to art direct a photograph, but I don't want to take it. And the same applies. If I was going to go anywhere, I mean, it's funny because my influences are not... They are television and photography and architecture and product design, much more than their graphic design, I think, really. Mm. So that's more where... I suppose, to sum it up, I would rather design a chair than do a pop promo. I'm sure that the most product designers would scoff at the idea that
you have actually designed a lot for product designers, haven't you?
Yes.
Books and identities.
Yes, interesting.
You know, obviously your work appeals... To them. I'm thinking of people like Jasper Morris and
Mark Newson
and so on. They obviously all lock into your approach, which has this quiet simplicity, this minimalist approach, which doesn't seem to threaten what they do. It seems to complement it very nicely.
I think that comes out of the fact that I really, you know, I've been lucky enough to work with some amazing product designers whose work I absolutely love. And yeah, I have an empathy, I suppose, with what they do, and it does appeal. I wouldn't pretend to, you know, when I talk about designing a chair, it's a very simplistic mindset. But then I go into most projects believing that I can design a logo for Esso just as well as I can design a record sleeve for Kylie Minogue. Mm. I really honestly believe that I can do that just as well. Mm. And I'm probably kidding myself to think that could filter through to product design. But I'll continue to kid myself, I think.
All right. Well, Mark Farrow, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.